welcome to Zoopa. My name is Megan Eamon. Today on the podcast, we'll be talking about archiving. First, I talk with Sarah Frank and Cole Worley, members of the Digital Writing and Research Lab's Digital Archiving Group. Then, you'll hear from Dr. Charlotte Nunes, co-chair of the Rapoport Center's Human Rights and Archives Working Group. These interviewees are dealing with archives in different ways, but they raise common concerns about the uses, challenges, and limits of archiving. Sarah and Cole are both PhD students at the University of Texas and members of the Digital Archiving Group, a research group in the Digital Writing and Research Lab. The Digital Archiving Group was created this past year with, at least initially, a single purpose: to archive materials that the lab has accumulated in its nearly 30-year history. As Cole and Sarah explained, this was no easy task, both because of the nature of the materials and the group's relationship to the Digital Writing and Research Lab.
Well, at first, I think we tried to tackle the material aspects of the archive first because they were tangible, they seemed like the easy target. And we went about haphazardly cataloging the actual physical materials and thinking about how that catalog would look. So this would be sort of applying what we might think of as a traditional archive methodology. You know, what's the author, what's the title. But for a lot of the materials in the archive, they couldn't be expressed in that format. So for instance, we would encounter a DVD which on it there would be old teacher folders, lesson plans, project groups from the early 2000s. Archivists sometimes get around this by organizing things into portfolios, but we quickly found out that most of the materials we were dealing with had to be enclosed in these kind of portfolios, and that the portfolio was a kind of out. It was a cheat to get out of a more fraught problematic of categorization.
I think, too, that constructing, like Cole said, a more traditional archive, you have a lot more sort of agency in the selection and collection and appraisal process. So, I mean, you think about our biggest archive here on campus in the traditional sense over at the Harry Ransom Center, and, you know, they'll tell you all these stories about acquiring all of these records and sort of bringing them down to Texas, archiving them in the Harry Ransom Center. And I think of us as having less agency in that. I don't know if agency is always the best way to frame it, but I see us as having come into this kind of, this profoundly disorganized sort of heap of materials, some of which is garbage and some of which is really important to reflecting the history of the lab. And so ours has definitely been more of a sort of sorting arrangement process, if you kind of break the archival process down into stages. And we don't always know what we're working with. And I think we have only at best a limited sense of what is going to become of those materials or what people might do with them. But I actually think that that's where we intersect the most with a sort of traditional archive, is over this idea of how do you build a collection that could spin a narrative that then might be picked up by some sort of future, a guest of the archive that you can never really anticipate.
Yeah, I think that I think that has been the most tricky part for us to navigate, our relationship to what we might think of as archive construction. We didn't get to construct this archive. We didn't get to attend auctions and purchase the like author's libraries that we thought would be most emblematic or most needed in what we imagine the library to be. So we're doing very different work than the kind of work that's being done at the Ransom Center or any other like major collection. Instead, we're working, I think, as you were alluding to, Sarah, we're working in what we might think of as a kind of institutional history. Like, here we are given access to an archive, which is a way of flattering, like, a heap of documents and the detritus of just the operation of the business. And given access to that, we can create an archive. We can pretend that we're traditional archivists, that we get to pick and choose. But our institutional focus, it doesn't give us the same amount of autonomy as, you know, the director of the HRC. We're not really directing this archive. We are participating in the building of the DWRL, but we're doing it in like an archive space.
The many formats in which lab members have stored data have created particular issues for the digital archiving group. The group was confronted with stacks of paper, VHS tapes, CDs and DVDs, and online workspaces with varying degrees of accessibility.
I find that the question about digital archive cultivation, which is at the heart of what the group is doing, is also the most relevant, because we all manage digital archives. Usually, if you're like me, it's an inbox whereby my intellectual production over the last 5 years is found in email attachments as I send them to advisors and to myself to print. And which is to say, it's a complete disaster that 10 years down the road, I will not be able to find anything. Mm-hmm. So with the problem of the digital has been complicated for us, because when we started looking at the materials, we were not just encountering the current regime of organization, PBWorks. We were looking at everything that they had tried beforehand. So I spent a lot of time combing through teacher folders, which in some ways is a superior form of organization than PBWorks. It has different problems. But what became apparent was the fragility of the different digital like modes. If the file itself is something that is relatively stable, that can be backed up and copied indefinitely, although there are limits to that, the system of organization is in such a state of flux that it makes us want to take refuge in, you know, the cloth binding of a library's index or something. Mm-hmm. And this is an area that I think we have started to seriously address in our last few meetings and thinking about the future work of the group and what we want to make this year ultimately about. Is there a better way to organize information in an era where the new platforms will be phased in and out at a regularity, like faster than a presidential administration? That's a little terrifying from an archivist's point of view, and I can see why the notion of a digital library is something that we have been slow in adapting, because there's something, we know that books can last 1,000 years, but we haven't had a hard drive that long, right? So I think there have been two things, in short, about the digital footprint of the archive. One is the fragility of platform, and the other problem with it is something that I hadn't talked about quite yet. The other problem with digital archives are the fragility of file types. The doc, for instance, what we're always typing into, has been relatively stable. But that's been the exception rather than the rule. Mm-hmm. And I think, especially going forward, it's very difficult to come up with a concrete archival schema or best practices when you don't even know what the basic element of the archive will be.
Sarah got into more detail about the challenges of archiving PBWorks wikis, which many lab instructors use as course websites. In courses that use the learning record, a portfolio-based grading system, students often upload all of their work and their final portfolios to a personal folder on a PBWorks wiki. There are advantages to working this way, but as Sarah pointed out, PBWorks can create problems for archivists.
Not only are these pages that have been placed on the PBWorks workspace unstable because they don't even have a file extension, a lot of them, they're also, you can't even get to some of them. And they sort of tend to disappear into this black hole of PBWorks. And I think that you can see in that problem that PBWorks is a workspace. And so it's something where, you know, a project who's working on a group in the moment, in the present, can share their work with each other, start aggregate ideas and things like that. But not something where a final product or a final project should be stored. So I think that that's one issue. And then also just the lack of protocol for organization. I think that's something else that aligns us in a curious way with the sort of more traditional material archive is that, to me, the PBWorks functioning as an archive is representative of sort of a warehouse with a lot of boxes, mm-hmm. and a lot of, shoe boxes within cardboard boxes and piles of different sorts of materials that is really hard to make meaningful, and I'm not sure that we as a group have decided if that making meaning is part of our function.
Considering how to translate these difficult formats has also raised questions for the group about the nature of their project.
Yeah, I think about our very first meeting, and one of the things that we ran across, which I've thought about constantly, it's been something that we've invoked. First meeting, when we got together, I thought it might be nice to just open up the archives. So we pulled all the books from the shelves, we started rummaging through them, and one of the first objects we came across were VHS tapes. And VHS tapes seemed like a good starting point, like our little emblem of our mission, right? How do we copy the tape into a digital platform? What do we do with that file? Do we put it on YouTube? Do we even have the rights to this file? And there were a whole host of questions that could be answered with something like a white paper. And it was very easy to imagine the group taking a route that would end with a series of white papers on how to pull video off of VHS. But I think when we got a little bit deeper, we realized that we had actually run into a much bigger problem. And I think, Sarah, you're right to talk about how that problem aligns us with traditional archives. Because what we're really talking about is accessibility, mm-hmm. right? Like, okay, if we have a hypothetical VHS and we rip it to YouTube, we've made that object accessible. We've also changed it, because what's on YouTube is not the VHS, but people can view it for now. So the impulse to archive is an impulse to pull things out of the spotlight, mm-hmm. right? Like we always have to be very careful about conflating those two poles, or to think that there's this utopian way that everything can be accessible all the time. Another place where you see this is with images. So if you are backing up a 3.5-inch floppy disk, you wouldn't copy those files into a folder, both because you're going to lose certain types of data, and because you lose those types of data, it's simply not an adequate representation of the object. So instead, you take an image of it. Now, the image can't be read. The image could be mapped onto a virtual drive, or it could be mapped onto another floppy disk. But it holds its integrity. And CD images work the exact same way. You can't just open a CD image unless you sort of use virtual drives and you unencode it all. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, images, it's like putting things in an opaque box. Like, you can't see what's in it. So, this gets us to something else that we spend a lot of time thinking about, which is our role potentially as curators or exhibitors. And I think this dawned on us slowly, but it seems stone obvious in retrospect. When you take an archive to exhibition, you are transforming those objects into mm-hmm. something completely different. And in many cases, you are generating approximations, right? In the same way that you don't want to show them the marble statue, so you show them the plaster cast or something, right? So we were debating, for instance, doing a exhibition on Daedalus. And as I was kind of working through the logic, we were talking about it in our group, it occurred to me that the best way to show an audience what Daedalus was all about was by building a virtual approximation of what Daedalus is. Daedalus was a writing experiment that used computers in a kind of proto-chat room to allow people in a computerized classroom to read each other's writing and to sort of work in a kind of shared space on the page, which is, say, on the screen. But in putting that kind of work on an exhibit, we wouldn't just want to give them the programs because they don't run on any modern OS. So instead, we'd have to be building a JavaScript applet and trying to really recreate that archival object, which seems so contrary to what it is to archive in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been a fraught intersection.
As Sarah notes, the very idea of the project can be problematic, but has also raised questions for her about her own work on rhetoric and historiography.
Something that has continually struck me about the archive in the digital lab is that, and this is something that is talked about in the essay that Derrida talks about in the essay Archive Fever, that the archive's always moved outside of what it's attempting to archive. And so, you know, while we see the archive is emblematic of the sort of institutional history, at the same time, it has to be moved outside of the lab itself in a lot of ways. You know, you've got to move these files off of PB Works. You've got to build this exhibit and make sure that it's external to the lab because of accessibility, which already implies, you know, an outside and an inside that you can, you know, bridge this gap by access. But also as a way of that you can't necessarily remember, or there's no sort of place for remembrance when these materials are still within the institution. And so I've been thinking a lot about that idea in terms of history and historiography, and trying to think of historical narratives having a spatial dimension in addition to a temporal dimension, where, you know, these narratives of, say, like the origin of rhetoric in ancient Greece have to be sort of externalized in some ways from that historical material location. And I think that that complicates the way that you write histories and read histories. And, you know, and so I think that that kind of ties back in through my research into this idea of, is it our function to construct narrative? And is it our function to suggest ways that meaning could be made out of these sort of fragmented materials? Because that's really what history writing and historiography to me is about. And I think that we assumed coming in that that would be part of our function, and that that's something, because of the difficulties that have presented itself in trying to create that meaning, I think that that's something that we've sort of had to question.
Thanks to Sarah and Cole for sharing their thoughts on the Digital Archiving Group's project and process. Our second interview today is with Dr. Charlotte Nunes.
So my name is Charlotte Nunes, and I defended my PhD here at the UT English Department last summer. And since then, I've been lecturing in world literature and co-chairing the Human Rights and Archives Working Group, which is supported by the Rappaport Center. I co-chair it with Anne Sekovich, faculty member in the English Department and also in the Center for Women's and Gender Studies, and with T.K. Sanglant, who's the Human Rights Archivist at the Human Rights Documentation Initiative, which is an enterprise of the UT Libraries. So the three of us co-chair the working group, and we're really interested in fostering conversation about critical approaches to teaching and analyzing and building archives, how to make existing archives on campus a little bit more radical, how to practice archival analysis maybe in a little bit more of a radical way. And we're also very interested in coordinating archives with humanities education on campus. That's a particular interest of mine. So I've been sort of the point person for archives and education.
What might radicalism look like in this context? As Charlotte explained, there are a few options.
Yeah, so it goes a few different, it sort of flows, the radicalism flows a few different directions. So, of course, there's the idea of analyzing or taking a sort of sociopolitical lens to the archives that exist on campus. So someplace like the Harry Ransom Center, of course, has incredible records and archives of 19th and 20th century British and American culture. And the idea with the Human Rights and Archives Working Group is to think about what kind of artifacts might be buried in there that might shed some light on histories of structural injustice, structural inequality. So it's sort of sociopolitical approach to archival analysis and being particularly attuned to archival collections or archival artifacts that may be below the radar, but that would shed some light on histories of maybe queer communities and communities of color, sort of the sort of race, gender, class trifecta, sort of having a sensitivity to that in the process of archival analysis. And then also the idea of building archives and building relationships between the UT community and the Austin community at large. So I'm working on a project right now as part of in my capacity as co-chair of the Human Rights and Archives Working Group, where I'm collaborating with the acting director of the Texas After Violence Project to provide an opportunity for UT undergraduates to learn about digital archives by building them and to learn about human rights and archives by participating in the process of building and processing archives. So we have a fantastic team of about 5 UT undergraduates, all of whom I recruited from the Bridging Disciplines programs, where I used to be a graduate assistant. So I had built some relationships with really stellar undergrads already, and I was able to sort of take advantage of that network that I had. And I invited, you know, alongside Rebecca, we invited these students to participate in processing Texas After Violence interviews for the Human Rights Documentation Initiative. So Texas After Violence is a local Austin-based oral history nonprofit that focuses on building histories, drawing out histories of how the death penalty has affected communities around Texas.
Human Rights and Archives Working Group also works to destabilize understandings of how archival materials can support human rights projects. As Charlotte explains, this work does not have to function as legal evidence. Rather, it can tell a different story.
But absolutely, I mean, for me, it's easy to come back to the Texas After Violence Project example because that's one that I'm very familiar with. And that is a human rights archives project that certainly wouldn't discount itself from a lobbying or advocacy purpose, but that's not its primary purpose. Its primary purpose is to provide testimony about how the death penalty has influenced communities around Texas. And the founder of the Texas After Violence Project, he is really interested in looking at the death penalty as a public health issue, which is pretty provocative. So sort of looking at the relationship between public health and the death penalty in Texas. So he has sort of a sociological perspective on it. But that would be one way. I mean, I think the idea with the Texas After Violence Project is to create an archive that will both influence and serve as a source for public discourse around the death penalty, and that will also serve as a resource for scholarly research. So Naomi Pike is an example of a faculty member who has used the Texas After Violence Project archive in her teaching. So she had a unit. She's an American Studies professor, and she had a unit on the Texas After Violence Project. And the oral history testimonies that constitute it. So I would say that that's kind of a great example of the ways that archives can figure in human rights discourse and advocacy, but that is not necessarily about prosecution.
Charlotte also talked about how she uses digital archives to teach world literature, in particular, to complicate students' understandings of certain authors' bodies of work.
I think archives do incredible work for contextualizing literature. So if you have any interest in literature and history, archives are just fantastic resources. And teaching archives is second nature to history teachers, but there's a little bit less of a precedent for incorporating archives in teaching literature. But those precedents are developing and they're growing.
And is that typically how you would use the archives in your class to sort of contextualize works that they're reading?
Well, what I found is really useful in my class. I found archives are useful for complicating some writers' positions on imperialism. So a figure like J.E. Kaisley Hayford or Leonard Wolfe, these are both pretty obscure figures, but they're writers that I teach in World Lit, who, if you judge by their literature, if you judge by their fiction, they look very anti-imperial. They sound very anti-imperial. They sound as though they hold this unequivocal position against empire. However, the archives reveal that their anti-imperialism may have looked a little bit different than that, that they may have been willing. So, for example, I'm thinking about J.E. Kaisley Hayford's contributions to the African Times and Orient Review, where he indicates that it may be the right and strategic thing to do to try to appeal to the imperial powers as opposed to sort of radically oppose them. Mm-hmm. He's more invested. You wouldn't know it from his fiction, because his fiction is extremely satirical of European colonial powers. But if you look at the archives, if you look at these sort of archival materials, it looks like he's more invested in reforming than opposing the empire. And the same thing goes for Leonard Wolfe. His fiction sounds very unequivocally anti-imperial, but his reports about his testimony to the colonial office and the anti-slavery and aborigines friend. It's a long title of a periodical that was the periodical of the Anti-Slavery Society. Reports of his testimony to the colonial office in this publication indicate, he says something to the effect of, we need to regain the confidence of the Ceylonese. Like, we need to. So it's, again, the archives indicate more of a, this investment in reforming instead of overturning or subverting the empire. So you just get, it, it sort of provides some nuance to the, these writers' positions on anti-imperialism. It would be very easy to teach these writers as anti-imperialists. But if you provide that sort of archival aspect to it, it complicates that in a really useful way. And I think that the students really connect with that. They're very, they find some good traction and some good points of, I think it's just sort of points of engagement. It's sort of interesting for them to engage with that nuance.
I asked Charlotte about the challenges of doing this kind of interdisciplinary archival project. Charlotte didn't describe challenges exactly, but rather the questions that bringing together scholars from different disciplines has raised for the group, as well as the overarching conceptions of the archive that the group is trying to combat.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely challenges. I think that when you bring together humanities scholars and School of Information scholars, you inevitably have some friction in terms of how you're defining archive. Just the archive itself, is it an institution that houses primary sources, or is it a much broader, theoretically fraught concept than that? So we certainly run across that. I wouldn't say that it's an obstacle or a problem. I think it's generative and productive. But I would say that there is some controversy over how to define the very term archive within the space of the working group. And you also have differing stakes and differing engagements. And I think that there's some risk of I think Tanya Clement put it really well. Tanya Clement is an iSchool faculty member, and she said, we really need to change the conversation. And she's a digital humanist. She does do some work with archives, but she's primarily a digital humanities person. And she says, so she's someone who's interested in building archives. And she says, we really need to change the conversation between archivists and educators. And it needs to be, you know, rather than educators approaching archivists and saying, what can you do for me? You're a service provider. On campus, what can you bring to my teaching and my classroom, my students' experience? She says we really need to completely change that conversation such that it's about two parties meeting. And she says we have to consider the fact that archives have their own missions and objectives. And so to sort of approach that conversation and say, are there ways in which my class's engagement with your institution, your archival, you know, your special collections can advance your goals? That's something I think is a kind of radical concept to sort of introduce. I mean, the idea, I think we, as educators, we have this idea that archives and libraries exist to service education, which is true to a certain extent. But it's also true that libraries and archives have missions and objectives. And I think for educators to be sensitive to those is one of the, is a goal of the working group, to sort of cultivate that type of attitude, this idea of two parties coming together to collaborate, as opposed to educators seeking the services of libraries and archives.
Thanks to Charlotte for participating in this interview. If you'd like to learn more about the Texas After Violence Project, the Human Rights and Archives Working Group, or the Human Rights Documentation Initiative, and you're here in Austin, you'll enjoy the Texas After Violence Project's Oral Histories in the Classroom panel and reception on March 20th. For more information, see texasafterviolence.org. That concludes this episode of Zeugma. To watch our archive as it develops, you can follow us on Twitter at Zeugma Podcast or on Facebook. Tune in 2 weeks, and we'll have an episode about laughing.